is binary black hole merger, symmetry, and the spin expansion. It's basically about material in these two recent papers, where this is like the letter. This is very short and delicious, and then this one is for not for the faint of heart. And then there will be some about forthcoming work with Mike Kessler. By way of introduction, so I'm going to be talking about binary black hole merger and how the final state, when two black holes merge, how the final state depends on the initial state. And this is a classic problem in general relativity, and progress on it was quite slow for decades. And then just over the past 2 years, there's been a lot of rapid progress. I just wanted to give a little bit of a taste of that, and a warning is that I'm going to give a completely distorted representation of my own and simple contribution to that. Okay, so to start, let me say so. As you all know, the two-body problem, so the problem of how two particles move under their mutual gravitational interaction, in Newtonian gravity, that was solved a long time ago. I mean, it can't even give an archive reference for it. In GR, the situation is not so simple. In GR, even the one-body problem was only solved in 1963 by Kerr, and with his famous metric for the sort of general stationary black hole. And it's worth remembering that although we sort of take this metric for granted now, that it's kind of it's amazing that Einstein equations are a nonlinear equation. In general, you don't expect to be able to find explicit simple solutions to the sort of nonlinear equation. And so the fact that the general solution for the black hole can be just written down on a piece of paper in this sort of simple form, this is the Kerr metric, and it's equal to a sort of auxiliary Minkowski space plus this piece, where H and K are simple functions. H is harmonic with respect to this background metric, and K is geodesic and null and shear free with respect to the background metric. And it's just this very beautiful solution. It's kind of, I pointed out just because, this was the start of a 10-year period which revealed that in the problem of one black hole, the overarching theme was that it had sort of magical properties. It had many properties that were much simpler and more beautiful than might naturally have been expected. So what about the two-body problem? Well, so the first thing to say, I keep getting ahead of myself these slides. The first thing to say about the two-body problem is that a characteristic feature of the general relativistic two-body problem is that it turns into the one-body problem, right? So if you have two black holes orbiting one another under their mutual self-gravity, they emit gravitational radiation, they gradually inspiral, and eventually they merge to form a single black hole. So it's really characteristically different than what happens in Newtonian gravity. And a classic and important problem is, how does the mass and spin and final kick velocity of the final merged black hole, how does it depend on the initial state, the masses and spins and configuration of the two initial black holes? So to my knowledge, one of the first concrete results in this problem was obtained in this beautiful 1.5 page paper by Stephen Hawking. This paper, You probably are familiar with the contents of this paper, although you wouldn't know it by the abstract. This is the paper where in about half a page, Hawking proves the law of area increase, which the area of black hole horizons always increase from one time slice to another. And he gives a very simple, elegant argument. He basically just argues that every generator that passes through the event horizon on this time slice has to also pass through the event horizon on this time slice, because that. And that furthermore, if there are no singularities outside of the black hole, if all the singularities are contained within the black hole horizons, then the expansion, if you look at a little family of null geodesics around the geodesic of interest, they must be non-contracting. So that means that if you follow the little cross-sectional area that pierced through this horizon, it has to also appear in the subsequent horizon with an area that's at least as big as it was here. And then furthermore, new black holes may form, new GRF, new null generators of horizon area can form in the meantime. And so the horizons on this surface has to be at least as big. So now, of course, this result is famous because it was one of the key results that led to the recognition that black holes, that their horizon area is representative of their entropy and that they have a thermodynamic interpretation. And so, you know, a lot of people here work in quantum gravity. You think that paper was for you, but no. That result was actually proved for me, for what I'm interested in, for binary black holes. So he once he's proved that result, then he also knows there's a simple formula for the area of a Kerr black hole. And this is another, I mean, I can't resist saying another great historical point about this paper is that, so again, because this was before people realized the fundamental importance of the area of a black hole horizon, even though this paper was published 8 years after Kerr's paper in 1963, no one had published yet the area of the black hole horizon. And so for this result, he has to cite a private communication from Roger Penrose. Anyway, but so fine. So he knows the area of a single black hole, and he knows the areas must increase. So he can say that the area of the final black hole, as a function of its mass and spin, has to be greater than or equal to the area of the two initial black holes. And in this way, he gets basically the first non-trivial constraint on the mass and spin of the final black hole, as a function of the initial black holes. And the interesting thing about this is that, you know, it's a completely non-dynamical argument. He makes no attempt to actually solve for the dynamics of the system. And so that's great. But, you know, ultimately, you'd like to. So this was, as I say, maybe the first result, but people immediately wanted to get something that had an equality there instead of an inequality. And so no one managed to find a solution, an exact solution for two black holes. And so the community quickly turned to two other methods. So first of all, they developed, over the past several decades, they have been developing approximate techniques, primarily the post-Newtonian method. So the post-Newtonian method is a approximate solution of Einstein's equations, where if you have two bodies and they're moving, they're moving slowly relative to the speed of light, then you can write the gravitational force between them as the Newtonian force, gmm over r, squared, and then plus correction terms at each successive order in v over c. And so that has now been, the post-Newtonian technique has been developed to many orders. And it works wonderfully now. It's very accurate for following the binary when the black holes are well separated and moving non-relativistically. And so in particular, if you want to follow the dynamics or the gravitational waveform generated when the black holes are far apart, it's great for that. But the properties of the final black hole are determined largely by the final few orbits and the plunge when the black holes are not moving at speed small relative to the speed of light. And when even their independence as entities is even during periods where there's no longer two separate event horizons. So the post-Newtonian approximation is bad. It's poorly suited for questions about how the final state depends on the initial state. So the other thing that people tried was that people have been developing are numerical methods, and this is where really there was just recently a big breakthrough. So. By recently, I mean, so in 2005, this guy Franz Pretorius did the first successful simulation of two merging black holes, that's been a long-standing project. There's for three decades, multiple groups have been hard at work on figuring that out, and so it was really cobbling together a huge number of clever tricks to get that to work. And then, very interestingly, sort of. Immediately on the heels of that, several other groups with independent methods suddenly got their codes working. I mean, it seems like there was some sort of it was a breakthrough for a lot of different groups with different methods. And so now they're sort of order between 5 and 10 numerical groups that can reliably simulate the merger of two spinning black holes to a final black hole. And where here, I mean, it's complementary to the post-Newtonian approach. So the post-Newtonian technique gets the initial stages of the merger, say, up to the final orbit or couple of orbits, and the numerical relativity really does the remaining part. If you really want to get good resolution on the final merger, which is one of the main things they're interested in, you really only do the final couple orbits. Yeah.
But how do you know it's right?
Well, that's a very good question. So there's two things to say. One is that Multiple different groups have different codes, and they seem to be different codes with quite significantly different algorithms. They seem to be agreeing with one another. So some of that testing I can point. There's some maybe figures I could point to later on that would. I mean, we find consistency checks between them. But the other thing to say is that it's early. There are almost certainly systematic errors. I mean, every group admits that they're making one sort of systematic error or another, and they're very poorly characterized at this point. There's been a rush. It's been really just over the past year, people for the first time have been merging spinning black holes, and there turns out there have been all sorts of weird and interesting results coming out, and everyone's been rushing to get those results first, and no one really has time to. It tends to be. I think people tend to admit that the attitude is sort of get, you know, let's do the exciting stuff as fast as possible, and then we can go back and make sure we have all the keys crossed. And you might say, well, if they can merge the two black holes numerically, maybe the problem is just solved, right? I could use post-Newtonian techniques for this part, numerical relativity for the final stage. What more do I need? And there are two answers to that, which is that, so, you know, first of all, you would like, the first point is just a practical one, that these numerical simulations turn out to be exceptionally time intensive. So they're depending on what resolution, how accurate a simulation you're trying to do, how much checking you want to do, it's tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of CPU hours per simulation. Whereas, as I'll explain in a minute, you know, the parameter space that you want to probe, the parameter space that you want to map out, is at least in the simplest case seven-dimensional. So there's a mass ratio, and then there's three components of this spin and three components of this black hole spin at a fixed initial separation. And so even if you just naively laid down 10 grid, you know, just tried to crudely grid out that space, laid down 10 grid points along each direction, that's 10 to the 7 simulations. It turns out that's not, well, 10 to the 7 simulations is completely out of the question. That takes longer than the age of the universe. And so you need some theoretical input that allows you to more efficiently map out the space with the modest number of simulations that you are able to do. And then the other thing is just, of course, it's like asking, you know, if back in 1963 I could easily simulate the collapse of matter to a rotating black hole, you know, I don't need to convince anyone that there's a huge amount of additional value in having an analytic understanding of what goes on with a rotating black hole. I mean, these simulations are incredibly useful, but for both practical and conceptual reasons, it's important to have some analytic understanding to go along with it. Okay. So we just have a simple so this project was really enjoyable, more than probably any other project I've ever worked on, because it had this sort of puzzle quality where a couple data points would roll in one paper, and they seemed to exhibit some trend. This maybe exhibited some trend, and we were like, oh, what's the explanation for that trend? And we had maybe a couple ideas, and like a couple more rolled in, and we were like, oh, you know, it had this sort of very sort of it was like a detective show. It was amazing, and it was great. But so in the end, the technique which we think is right and which we think does a good job of describing simulations, and sort of understanding some of the results that come out, or I should say some aspects of the results that come out. As far as we know, it doesn't disagree with any of the simulations. It's just, as you'll see, it doesn't explain everything. It explains some things. So the idea is to say, instead of trying to follow the dynamics in detail, we regard the merger process as a map from a simple initial state, two widely separated Kerr black holes. Each of these Kerr black holes is sort of a most perfect macroscopic object you could hope for, characterized by just a mass and a spin. So it's a map from that initial state to a final state, where the final state is a single Kerr black hole with a mass and a spin and some kick velocity. And the question is, how much about that map can you learn just by demanding that there are certain simple symmetries of the system under which the initial data, the initial spins and masses transform in according to simple rules, and the final data transform according to simple rules. And so under the demand that whatever map maps from the initial to the final data respect those rules. So I'm just going to illustrate, rather than doing the general case, I'm just going to illustrate with an example. So what do I mean by K1? So I imagine setting up my black hole at some initial instant, my binary at some initial instant like so, and I'll define an orthonormal triad as follows. Let me define the one direction as the direction, instantaneous direction from black hole A to B. The two direction is the direction that the black holes are orbiting, and the three direction is the direction of the angular momentum. And when the black holes are very far apart and moving non-relativistically, all those three directions are perfectly well defined in the center mass frame. So my initial data, I'm going to assume for starters that the black holes are in a circular orbit. That turns out to be the case of physical interest, because it turns out that if you have an eccentric binary, if you have a non-circular binary, it radiates angular momentum slower than energy. So the black hole always relaxes to the minimum of its effective radial potential, and so it relaxes to a circular orbit. And so by the time astrophysical binaries, for example, enter the LIGO band or the LISA band, they're expected to certainly the LIGO band, they're expected to all be circular, and then the LISA band there's exotic cases that won't be circular. So to specify the initial data for a circular binary, it turns out you need to give seven numbers, namely the ratio of this mass to this mass, and then the three components of this spin relative to that triad I defined before, relative to this triad. Okay, so I project these three components, and Q. Those are my initial numbers. And then I'll project the final quantities onto the same triad. So here I'm asking, what can I say about the, this was my one direction here. I'm going to say, what can I say about the kick velocity in the one direction at the end of the final black hole? So as the two black holes merge, one thing that can happen is that they can emit gravitational waves asymmetrically. So for example, there's a net linear momentum in that direction at the end of the merger, emitted in gravitational waves. And so to conserve momentum, the final black hole will have a kick velocity in this direction. And so I'm asking now, what is the component of that kick velocity along the one direction of my triad? How does that depend on my seven initial data?
Why isn't there an initial velocity in this?
I'm just going to the center of mass frame of the binary initially when it's in the Newtonian. So I'm asking, what is the kick velocity relative to the center of mass frame of the whole system?
All right.
Okay. So now what I'm going to do, the next thing I'm going to do is Taylor expand in those six spin components, and that sounds like it's going to be a horrible mess, and you might say that doesn't sound like a very good next step, but very good idea, but I assure you that we had other ideas that were much worse than that before we realized that. So this is the one we went ahead with. Okay, so I'm schematically representing that this way. So here there's an implied sum from 0 to infinity over all of those six indices, m1, m2, m3, n1, n2, n3. So that's just writing down every term in the Taylor expansion. And so again, it looks like a mess. Looks like naively at zeroth order, looks like there's going to be one term, and then at first order there's going to be six terms. Second order there's going to be 21 terms, it turns out. So the term looks like there will be a huge number of terms. Yeah, good point. Let me get so here I'm imagining here I'll say more about that at the end of this slide. But so here I'm saying at a fixed initial separation, some arbitrary initial separation, but fixed, vary the initial spin configuration and mass ratio. How does the final kick velocity depend on that? Then we'll ask about it. So, but it turns out that the symmetries improve life, the symmetries of the system improve life a bit. So here I've just written out the first two orders in Taylor expansion, keeping only the terms that don't vanish by a symmetry. Okay, so what does this say? Oh, I should say, by the way, for simplicity, I'm starting with the case of Q equals 1, equal mass black holes, and then in a minute I'll discuss when Q is not equal to 1. Q, did I mention this? Q is MA over MB. It's the ratio of mass ratio.
A very sophisticated question, but is it even well defined? The single mass of the hole in this case is all. I mean, When they're far apart, I guess, but.
Right, that's right. So only in the limit where they're far apart are their masses and spins well defined. As you get them closer and closer together, they gradually become fuzzier and fuzzier concepts. Eventually they become.
So your initial conditions are set when they're.
Early enough that it's a good approximation to specify the data. Now, it turns out that doesn't have to be very early. So as you'll see, this turns out to do a great job of describing simulations, even though the simulations only begin 3 orbits before Mercury. Okay, so what this says is, first of all, we said there was going to be a zeroth order piece, but actually that turns out to die. So there's no zeroth order piece. So that says that if you merge, the fact that there's no zeroth order piece says physically that if you merge two unspinning black holes of equal mass, there's no kick. Okay, now why did it vanish? It vanished because in my initial map, you know, the point is that I can imagine relabeling black hole A and black hole B as black hole A and black hole B. So what will happen then? Well, of course, it's the same physical system. I've just renamed them. So the final kick velocity in this direction is not going to change. But I had defined the one direction to point from black hole A to black hole B, so that will change. And so since K1 is the dot product between the kick velocity and the one vector in my triad, that'll flip sign. But then also I have to send Q to 1 over Q, and when I do this relabeling, Q goes to 1 over Q and the A's swap with the B's. And the result is that you find that the coefficient that I call M1, M2, M3, M1, M2, M3 for K1 has to be equal to the opposite of the same coefficient but with the M's and N's switch. So in particular, that means that the 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1 has to vanish. Okay, so that's how that guy goes. So what now at first order, we said naively in the first order Taylor expansion, you would have expected 6 terms, but instead there's only 1. Okay, so neglecting the second lines here. So this is now the leading order prediction of this formalism. So the leading order prediction is that the magnitude of the kick in this direction, as I vary the spin configuration, to a first approximation, it will not depend on the spin components, the initial spin components in the plane. It'll only depend on the spin components in the direction of the angular momentum, and in particular only on their difference. Okay? So that indeed is borne out by simulations, as I'll show in a minute. But let me just say again, how did we get down from 6 to 1 term like that. So the terms proportional to A1, A2, B1, and B2 all got knocked out because under a parity transformation, the kick vector is a vector under parity, so it'll switch sign. The one vector, the vector pointing from black hole A to black hole B, is also a vector. So the dot product of the two is a scalar under parity. Whereas the spin components, the spins, A vector and B vector, those are pseudovectors, of course. But the triad components in the one direction and two direction, I'm going to try to make this as brief as possible because I have a feeling I'm probably losing everybody. But the two of the triad components are vectors, whereas the third triad element is a pseudovector. And so what it means is that A1 and A2, B1, B2, those are all pseudoscalar quantities, whereas A3 and B3 are scalar quantities. So A1 and A2 have the wrong parity. So any term proportional to them, or an odd number of them, has to vanish. Okay, so we've cut down just to an A3 and a B3 term, and then the exchange symmetry, the relabeling A and B, that ultimately says that those two terms aren't independent. They just appear together in this combination, A3 minus B3. Okay, and then you keep going to higher orders, and as I said, they're of order 20 and a few terms at second order in these expansions. But they typically get cut down to 4 or 5 terms by similar sorts of symmetry arguments. And so what these say is that at first glance you should get something proportional to the simple combination A3 minus B3. But then if you look closer, there should be residuals about that fit that have a very specific dependence on the initial spin. And so I'm going to explain this one in detail, but I just want to. This works really well. Okay, this is a surprising fact about that has come out of these numerical simulations of binary black hole merger, is that the first couple orders in this expansion, the first two orders in the expansion, seem to describe the simulations that have been done thus far with, you know, extraordinarily good accuracy, very surprisingly good accuracy. So that part, you know, if going back here, the symmetry arguments, I mean, there's a reason that those work, but it was just an assumption that when I did this Taylor expansion that it was converging, that the first order term in the spins was more important than the second order term. You know, I don't really know why that is. I mean, I could kind of come up with kind of hand wavy reasons, but I don't really know the reason that is. And I think it was rather unexpected in the sense that what people were imagining was that when two spinning black holes merge, initially their spins are they torque one another very, very small amount because they're so tiny, but as they get close enough to one another, they begin to torque each other significantly, and the spins were expected to flip in weird ways and get this kind of whipping motion at the end that would bring in very high powers of the spin into the dependence of the final state. And that appears, based on the limited number of simulations that have been done so far, to not be the case. Well, that's true. Exactly. If I was going to give a hand-wavy explanation, it would be that it turns out that when you actually look at how fast the black holes rotate, they're kind of, although I should say, you know, they're rotating by order 2 pi. I mean, they can be precessed by order 2 pi by one another during just the final orbit. So,
but.
Not much more than 2 pi.
But just to clarify, in that series of spins, you get every turn of all orders by having the interface parity.
That's the only symmetry I've used so far.
And
so. If there are, we haven't used them. I don't, and I don't know what they are. Well, it turns out that every data set that we've, so there have been roughly six data sets, each of which contains on average maybe 15 data points. Okay, and those each of those data sets typically corresponds to some configuration where one parameter is varied in the initial condition. Just one second. And it turns out that for all of those except for one, that the first two orders in the often just the first one, but more generally the first two already provide a great fit, so we don't go to third order. But there is one data set that we need to go to third order to explain it. We don't understand what that is, to be honest, but. Ah, very, very good point that I forgot to mention. Yes. Excellent question. Sorry, this is something I should have said a slide ago, and I didn't. So, the spin of a Kerr black hole has a maximum value. In units where g equals c equals 1, a Kerr black hole cannot have an angular momentum bigger than its mass squared. So when I write down a and b here, these are all the spin, dimensionless spins, the angular momentum of the black hole in units of its mass squared. So these all vary between 0 and 1. Now, since they can vary between 0 and 1, we didn't know. Another way to say, when I said we were surprised that the Taylor expansion works, another way to say it is that we thought that the Taylor expansion would work as long as you looked for sufficiently small dimensionless initial spins, but we expected it to break down as people began to simulate large initial spins of order 1. But the typical spin in these plots here is kind of 0.6, 60% of maximal, 60, 70, 50. It turns out to be, if they could have, they would have simulated maximum spin. They were trying to get the wackiest results possible. But it turns out that you know, there's an outstanding problem of how to write down physically realistic initial data for black holes, which is not solved. It's outstanding. That's redundant. But it turns out that what they write down instead is unphysical initial data. But it's data that becomes more and more distorted relative to a physical black hole as the spin gets big. And so to, they begin to not trust their results for, they typically haven't been simulating above 0.8 because the initial data really is not very physical above 0.8. It's, the black holes are getting very distorted relative to that. There is no conformally flat slicing of Minkowski space, of Kerr space-time, but the initial data that they write down for various reasons, basically to get, for various reasons, every code uses conformally flat initial data, and so there's some conformally flat initial data that approximates a Kerr black hole, but is not, and so it gets worse and worse in the limit. Because Schwarzschild has a conformally flat slicing, so as the spin decreases, you get the conformally flat initial data becomes a better and better approximation.
Yeah, what are these curves and dots mean?
Sorry.
If you said it, I missed it.
No. If I was going to flash through these and then go, but so, every dot is a data point. Okay, so that roughly gives you a sense of how many simulations have been done. Now there's maybe about a factor of two more than shown here, but okay, so there's
a data point from a numerical
simulation. A single simulation. You set up a single set of initial conditions, merge, and find the final kick, spin, and mass. And so various different plots here. This one is some final kick data for a particular one parameter family of initial data. This one looked like I can't do it. These guys here were spins pointing in equal and opposite directions, and then they vary the angle of the initial data like this, where this is the orbital plane, and then here spins pointing in opposite directions. Oriented like this, and they change the initial angle of orientation like that, where again, this is the orbital plane. These guys were various different spins where both spins were aligned with the direction of the orbital angle momentum initially. These guys are arbitrary initial spins. They just chose 8 different data points and moved them around. So a point about this was that, so for example, if you look at the final plot there for M, asking about how consistent the simulations are with one another, We calibrated our expansion, the first two orders, the relevant coefficients against these simulations, and then we just used those calibrated coefficients, here to fit, and they give a pretty good fit. So this maybe gives you
the lines are your fit.
So in all of these things, the lines are our fit. Except for in that one where, sorry, that the red X's are our fit, the black points are the data points.
So what's the ratio of data points to number of parameters you've got? Because you've got a lot of K's and A's.
Yeah, good question also. So in each case, the number of parameters is significantly less than the number of data points. We didn't include any plots where that wasn't the case. So the reason, it looks naively like for example, I showed that expression for K and up to second order, there were 6 coefficients in there. But since all of these are one parameter, rather symmetric families of initial data, it turns out that a lot of those parameters degenerate with one another. So you'll just have 1 or 2 fitting parameters. So in this first guy, in each panel there, in the bottom panel, there's 2 parameters, and then in each of the top 2 parameters, there's 3 parameters, not per curve, just for 3 parameters generates all the curves. In this guy, there was 2 free parameters. This was not a very impressive one. And again, in the bottom one here, there's no free parameters. In the middle one up there, there are 2 free parameters. So this is this sort of thing. I mean, we did the best we could. I mean, so it would be nice if we had more data points and fewer parameters, but we only have the data points that have been simulated. So.
Mike, what is the dimensionless parameter you're expanding in? I didn't get
the spin. The dimensionless spin. So the dimensionless spin has to be less than the unity.
We have 2 spins and they're nonlinear.
We're expanding in both of the dimensionless spins, and I agree, since it's nonlinear, a priori you might have expected any manner of wackiness. We didn't a priori know. But the proof is in the pudding. And
you take the dimensionless. What all those guys do in their simulations is they tell you what the dimensionless spins are, right?
Right.
And then all you got to play with are those k's, but you don't have as many k's as you think because you've got degeneracy.
Right. So
you've only got a couple of k's to fit all that stuff, right, which is not bad. Right.
That's exactly how I said it. That's basically
what I said. The key, because sensor of the key, what is it in terms of like the initial energy or something?
So it can be if you have maximally spinning black holes, it appears that the kick can be as big as 4,000 kilometers per second, which by astrophysical scale is huge. And that's big enough to kick you out of every astrophysical environment you could imagine. 4,000 kilometers per second will kick you out of a cluster, kick you out of a giant elliptical galaxy. But now, whether that is the typical value depends. Because the story is basically this. If the black holes are not spinning, then their maximum kick turns out to be only 200 kilometers per second. If they're highly spinning, but some mechanism has aligned them like this, so there are some claims, controversial, that in certain circumstances, black holes will have their spins aligned like this well before merger. In that case, the maximum kick is, by gas effects, in that case, the maximum kick is about 500 kilometers per second. But then as soon as you begin to have maximally spinning black holes that can have components, significant components of their spin pointing anywhere in the orbital plane direction, then that's when the kicks get really big. They get up into the thousands as the typical.
But there would be like a maximum possible field, right? I mean,
which is probably 4,000. So very small relative to the speed of light. You can't get a relativistic kick that appears from a circular line. Yeah.
But these are all order. Correct me if this is wrong. Order of magnitude enough to kick you out of the disk of a spiral galaxy.
It depends. 200 is not. So, for example, the escape, the Earth is rotating at roughly 200 around that. Right? So the escape velocity is even if there was no dynamic. So if you have a black hole moving through the galactic halo, a first approximation to what kick it needs to get out is the escape velocity from that potential, and that typically for a large spiral galaxy is a few hundred kilometers per second, maybe 500 depending on how large it is. But then you also have to take into account that as a giant black hole moves through a field of smaller stars, it's passing through, and those stars all get preferentially deflected.
Are we talking about a very massive black hole or a solar mass black hole?
Good question. So, first of all, the kicks, it doesn't matter what your total mass. The kick is a dimensionless. It's dimensionless in units where c is equal to 1. And so whether I have two stellar mass black holes that merge or I have two supermassive black holes that merge, they'll get the same kick velocity if they have the same dimensionless configuration. But like you say, a smaller kick velocity will kick a stellar mass black hole out of the halo, right, typically, than for a supermassive black hole. Supermassive black hole, you have to give some extra kick because it encounters sort of an effective dynamical friction due to its interaction with all the subsequent stars that it drags behind its orbit.
I have a very silly question. Why are these numbers so small? Why these kick velocities? Because is there any small dimensionless number that causes it, or just there's some conspiracy that?
They're small because what happens is that the gravitational radiation averages out over the so the total energy in units of the rest mass that's emitted during a circular orbit is a few percent. So the rest total rest mass energy of the initial two black holes, maybe 3, 4, or 5% of it gets emitted in total energy. So if all of that was emitted in one direction, then you might get a
30,000.
You might get a one or two orders of magnitude bigger than this. But in fact, what happens is that most of it. What you can think of is that each of these black holes, as they're moving, they're kind of beaming their radiation in the direction of motion, and so they're spraying momentum. And so it's for almost all the orbits, it's canceling. And that's why the systems that have the biggest kicks are the systems in which something breaks that symmetry. So whether it be the spin or the difference in mass between the two guys, and then the kick is dominantly generated at the end where they stop circularly orbiting and they do some sort of asymmetric plunge towards them. Okay, so I was just going to. Maybe in the interest of time, I was just going to say. So, for example, one thing to show that to just give you an illustration of how things are converging. So the spin expansion here, the leading order prediction says that the kick should vary as sine theta in this configuration, where theta is this angle where I have the spins initially like so. Whereas the final, the angular momentum radiated, the spin of the final black hole, the energy radiated, those should all orbit as sine 2 theta. Those should all vary as sine 2 theta, just because it, you know, those all have the same transformation properties with respect to those that exchange in parity symmetry. It also predicts, for example, that these two curves, which represent two different data sets with spins, slightly different initial magnitudes for the spins, that the amplitudes of these two sine waves should scale proportional to the size of the initial spins, and that indeed is borne out. And then, like I was saying, this is just the first order fit, and we predict that there should be higher order terms if you look closely at the residuals. In particular, in this case, you predict that the sine 2 theta residual should vanish, and the leading residual should be sine 3 theta, and that the amplitude of that leading residual should scale as the cube of the spin. And so that's what this next plot shows. For that plot I was just showing you, this is just a plot of the residuals. You can see that they do basically lie perfectly on sine 3 theta. And indeed, the amplitude is now the cube of the ratio of the initial spin. So this sort of thing, there's quite good evidence that the series is behaving as it's expected to. Okay, so far, it turns out that all the simulations that have been done so far, all of the initial, what I just said is no longer true. People have begun now to simulate non-equal mass black holes, but the initial simulations of spinning black holes were done at equal mass. That just turns out, for various practical reasons, to be easier for them to do, and it seemed like a simple thing to start with. And so all of the plots in the previous slide were of equal mass black holes, but with different spin configurations. So people are beginning to simulate unequal masses, so what can one say about unequal masses? So in other words, of the seven initial parameters that I specified, Q and the three components of this spin and the three components of this spin, what I've explained to you so far is kind of how at fixed mass ratio the final results depend on the spin configurations. But now another question is, how does it depend on the mass ratio? Can you use symmetry to say anything about that? And the answer appears to be yes. And, well, depending on the degree to which you regard the following argument as saying something about it. So I would like to basically play the same. I'm now like a well-trained animal. I just want to play the same game with Q that worked so well with the spin components. I want to basically expand about some sort of Taylor expansion about the point of symmetry. But whereas the spin components automatically were confined to this range -1 to 1 with the point of symmetry in the middle, and were automatically a sort of very natural thing to Taylor expand in, Q varies from 0 to infinity, and the point of symmetry is at Q equals 1. So the first thing I should do is change variables. So the simplest, so alpha here, this variable, is the simplest variable, simplest function of Q with the following properties: that first of all, it maps this range into this into the finite range -1 to 1. It maps the point of symmetry to the middle of that range, and then finally, under the transformation Q goes to 1 over Q, alpha goes to minus alpha. That's key for analogy with the expansions I was doing before, because again, the exchange symmetry maps Q to 1 over Q, and so I want certain terms to be knocked out by their parity under that. So again, I'm just going to illustrate this with a simple example. So I said in my expansion of K1 before that it vanished, but really it just vanishes for Q equals 0. For Q equals 1, for the equal mass case, which was the case I was displaying for you before. When Q is not equal to 1, it turns out that exchange symmetry limits the expansion to be only odd powers of alpha. Okay, and then I need to put in one additional bit of information, which is that it is known that, so again, this coefficient K000000 tells you about the merger of non-spinning black holes. Now, it is known that in the merger of non-spinning black holes via other arguments, I have to appeal to another argument, which is that for non-spinning black holes, the kick vanishes as Q squared. So in the limit that I have a test particle orbiting around a big Kerr black hole, the kick vanishes as Q squared. And so if I want to So that gives me two additional conditions, that this function has to vanish when q goes to 0, and its first derivative with respect to q has to vanish when q goes to 0. Those two algebraic conditions are going to fix two coefficients. And to satisfy them, it turns out I need to keep at least the first three terms in that series. So I keep the first three terms, impose those two conditions to demand that it vanishes q squared in the limit that q goes to 0. And you get this. But now this is a famous formula. This is the so-called Fitchett formula, derived by a post-Newtonian methods in 1983 by Fitchett. It was the prediction for what the it was the post-Newtonian prediction for how the final kick of the black hole should depend on the mass ratio in the case of non-spinning mergers. And just like I have a free coefficient there in front, Fitchett had a free coefficient in front because he took two Newtonian point particles, not even black holes. He just let them keep in spiraling, and they had no event horizon. So the closer he let them get before he cut off his calculation and called it unphysical, the bigger this coefficient B got. But the Q dependence stayed invariant as they in spiraled. And so people thought this was probably based on the fact that the Q dependence didn't seem to vary no matter as you let those two things vary, as you let them in spiral. They expected that might be a good approximation. So that Q dependence, so I claim, is it can be derived by the non-dynamical arguments that I just said. Now, in fact, people have done the one case where numerical simulators have explored in detail unequal mass is for this non-spinning case. They've done about 35 points varying from Q of 0.25, a mass ratio of 4 up to a mass ratio of 1. And it is rather well fit by this formula, but in fact, it was already noticed in that initial paper that it's exceptionally well fit by a slightly modified formula, where in this formalism, that slightly modified formula is obtained exactly by keeping one more term, and then imposing the two conditions, making it various q squared. So in other words, by that condition, you get this formula, which has two free parameters and fits these this curve of 35 data points. You know, it fits them all to 1% accuracy. It fits them all exceptionally well. So the Q dependence, I believe, can be understood also via non-dynamical arguments like this. But there's one additional point which Mike and I are working on this right now, and we don't know the answer. But I mean, for that one coefficient k0000000. You know how fast it vanishes as q goes to 0. But what we don't know yet is for an arbitrary coefficient, for the 131222 spin coefficient, you know, how fast does that thing have to vanish as q goes to 0? As soon as we have a neat formula for that, I can die happy. Anyway, so I just wanted to summarize a couple. Points. So there is no way that I can spin this, no pun intended, that would make this seem like sophisticated physics. It's like kid stuff, which is why I think it's great that kids don't read GRQC. It's very predictive. I want to emphasize that this is not just rederiving results obtained by other methods, but many of these predictions are not obtained. I mean, you know, yeah. There's basically no other. I don't want to say something too strong on camera. A lot of these predictions are new and cannot be obtained by other techniques. It complements previous techniques. In particular, it is complementary to numerical simulations, which, as I said, are simply too time-consuming to just brute force map out the space with them. And it provides some additional sort of intuitive understanding of what's going on in the results of the simulations. It complements post-Newtonian techniques because post-Newtonian techniques break down during the final few orbits, whereas here the point is we're not trying to follow the dynamics of the system. We're just using symmetry arguments that relate the early initial state to the final state, and really they in some sense implicitly hold through the entire orbit. You know, from a conceptual standpoint, it separates what is complicated and what about the final answer comes from the complicated nonlinear dynamics of the Einstein equations, and what comes from more elementary considerations. I would argue that that in some sense the free coefficients in our expansion are an efficient capturing of the input from the complicated nonlinear dynamics. It's efficient. I already mentioned this. I mean, basically, instead of the 10 to the 7 simulations that you might naively have to do, you know, you cut down the number dramatically. Basically, to map out the space with the same precision, you can do to second order accuracy in the spin expansion, if that's good enough for the astrophysical application you want, for example. You need of order 100 simulations, which is quite doable. And then just quickly, this is really putting the cart before the horse, because I didn't tell you about is why this problem is important. I mean, to be honest, to be perfectly honest, we didn't work on this. I mean, we just, it was a very fun puzzle to work on, but I should mention that there are important reasons too that you care about the map from the initial state to the final state. So first of all, for gravitational wave observations, a key observable is the gravitational waves in spiral, they merge to form a final black hole. Initially, that final black hole is a very distorted Kerr black hole, and then it rings down into these so-called quasi-normal modes. It's like a bell, and there's a series of modes that have decaying amplitude. The frequency is complex. It has some real part that represents the oscillation, and some imaginary part that represents the decay time. And that spectrum of quasi-normal modes depends on the Kerr black hole, the parameters of the Kerr black hole around which it is raining down. So if LIGO detects an inspiraling black, two inspiraling spinning black holes, if you can predict ahead of time what the mass and spin and kick of the final black hole are, you should be able to predict the quasi-normal mode spectrum, and then hopefully check that with observations. Another thing to say is that the way LIGO works is that it can be to know what signal you're looking for in advance is enormously helpful in terms of detecting the signal. The LIGO signals are buried in noise, and the way they detect the signals deep in the noise is they first have to have a theoretical template for what the signal should look like, and then they cross correlate the noise with their template, and they say which template produces a big cross correlation. And so in that respect, if you want to detect the quasi-normal final modes, it's enormously useful to have the mass and spin and kick of the final black hole, and therefore some idea ahead of time what the spectrum of modes is. And then for astrophysical purposes, I mean, this is, I can't do this justice, but I mean, I can't do it justice, A, because I'm not an astrophysicist, but B, because I have 2 minutes. But let me just say that the kick, you know, the distribution of kick velocities is important and observable astrophysically, or is linked to astrophysical observables in the sense that it's linked to what percentage of galaxies, what types of galaxies have final black holes, and what seem to not have final black holes. If the kick velocity for kick velocities big enough to kick you out of the galaxy. For kick velocities that are big enough to kick you significantly away from the center of the galaxy, but not all the way out, so you relax back in. Such kick velocities are thought to affect the distribution of stars and dark matter near the center of the galaxy. In terms of the distribution, when you look at a quasar, how many quasars are offset from the center of their host galaxy? How many AGN are offset from their AGN and quasars are thought to be enormously luminous, accreting supermassive black holes. How many of those are offset from their host galaxy? That depends on the distribution of final kick velocities in these mergers. I should say, because these mergers, the idea, I should have said this before, you know, it appears that virtually every galaxy has a supermassive black hole, which is maybe a million to a billion times the mass of our sun. And when these two galaxies merge, on a short time scale, dynamical friction escorts the two corresponding black holes to the center of the galaxy, where they become a bound pair, and are thought to then merge eventually via gravitational radiation. And so the final spins, the distribution of final spins is related to. So many galaxies are observed to have jets of radiation coming out of them, which A So an astrophysical observable, for example, is the orientation of the jet relative to the orientation of the host galaxy. Are they correlated with one another for certain types of galaxies? Are they uncorrelated for other types of galaxies? The directionality of the jet is the jet plays a very important role in the evolution of star formation in the galaxy. It injects a huge amount of energy in a very directed way. I did not leave myself as much time as I was hoping for the summary of the astrophysical implications, so I blitzed through them. But there are really a huge number of astrophysical observables that are linked to the mass, spin, and kick of the black holes formed by the merger of two supermassive black holes brought together by the merger of two galaxies. And so, anyway, maybe I'll end there.
Can you do a similar thing with the final spin?
Yeah, yes. So the final kick, the final mass, the final spin, all the different components, since different guys have slightly different transformation properties, their expansions look slightly different. And so they behave in different characteristics.
You have similar within bits.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, so when I was, I among the many things I went through too quickly, there's the slide, and so for example, the bottom panel here is the final mass in these mergers. The one for the same merger, the middle panel is the final spin of the black hole, and the top panel is the final kick of the black hole. This is a plot of kick. This is the final spin of the black hole, whereas this is the final kick velocity, and that's mass, spin, and kick. You can really do it for any final quantity that has simple transformation properties under parity and exchange.
In those three cell classes, the ratio of the second order coefficients to the first order coefficient.
That's a good question that I have to look up. The second order coefficients are smaller. They're not enormously smaller. They're small enough that at these spin values, which are kind of point, we have a visual representation. So. These spins are of order 0.7. Okay, so you can see that you can't really see, but so the amplitude of these curves is between plus 2000 and minus 2000. And then when I plot the third order residuals, the third order residuals vary between minus 100 and 100. So it's down by a factor of 20, third order relative to first order. But there's also, not all of that is the suppression of the coefficients, it's the suppression due to the factor of 0.7 squared, the factor of the spin here, third order instead of first. So, factor of, they're decreasing by of order, but less than 10.
I'm puzzled, still puzzled. If you have two emerging spinning black holes, the problem is it's not a linear system. So when you look for, you're trying to expand to solve the problem, some expansion, then the parameter of expansion must depend non-linearly on the spins.
The parameter of the expansion is the spins.
And also with the masses, this is the whole problem. I mean, how do you know how to expand the system? It's a non-linear dependent. You said that you're expanding in this, the dimension of spins as a dependent.
Right. So I'm using
justification for that.
That's, I agree with you. There's no a priori justification for it. But there appears to be, from a practical standpoint, great justification for it in the sense that it. So again, the basic point that I'm using, in other words, I'm not expanding about some Kerr solution or anything like that. I'm not expanding about some space-time. I'm saying when two black holes are well separate, we know that one black hole is, for all intents and purposes, literally physically described by a mass and a spin. And so if I have two black holes that are so far apart that their interaction with one another is negligible if they're relative to their self-gravity, then the initial state of the system is described by the mass and spin of this black hole and the mass and spin of this black hole. And so I'm just using that to say that if that really is all of the initial data I need, combined with the fact that they're put in an initial circular orbit, then whatever final quantity I'm interested in had better just be a quantity. All it can be is a function of the initial data that completely specifies the system, which are those 8 or 7 numbers. And so then we propose to expand in the initial spin values, to expand that unknown function in the initial spin values. And we did not have a good argument for why that should be a good approximation. But it is a good approximation.
But the point is that when you're solving these equations, you have a system of equations, you have to put in initial values.
But you're not solving that question. You're not solving any question. Just the case that somebody solved it at the computer, and the point is that there is a Taylor expansion, and they just start studying the coefficients of the Taylor expansion.
Right. So I'm not doing anything dynamical. So the simulations are putting in initial masses and spins. They're dynamically solving the in spiral and ring down, and then at the end of the day, they're computing the final mass, spin, and kick.
So you're saying
and I'm taking those output values.
You're saying the final result is not sensitive to the initial data.
It only appears to depend on the initial masses and spins. It is sensitive to the initial masses and spins, but that appears to be, to a good approximation, all of the sensitive. I mean, under the assumption that they're in circular orbit.
There's an algebraic mapping between the initial data and the final data.
So I'm trying to look at these diagrams and see, following on from your last point, whether you can turn the problem around and ask yourself, given that every large galaxy, at least the big ones, all seem to have a black hole,
yeah,
therefore they don't have large ejection velocities.
This is a puzzle that people are currently not. The solution is not so clear. So let me give you an example. So there was a very nice paper by this guy Jeremy Schnittman who pointed out that. Let's assume that when two black holes merge, that they're ejected with 100, that the final black hole is ejected with 100% probability. Okay, then if you just ask then as the universe evolves, what fraction of galaxies have a black hole in them? The answer is not zero; it's a half, even in that extreme case, because once you get down to only half of the galaxies having black holes in them, then the average merger merges a galaxy with no black hole and a galaxy with a black hole. Steady state is a half. And so it's not clear. It's not at all. So that's one issue. Another issue is that some mergers are gas rich and some mergers are gas poor. I mean, you know this better than I. And depending on how much gas is present. The black holes may or may not have more of a tendency to align their spins either with one another, or with the overall angular momentum of the gas cloud in which they're embedded. If they align their angular momentum, for example, like this, if they both align with the angular momentum of the gas cloud that they're embedded in, then it turns out that the maximum kick you get is 500 kilometers per second. Which is down significantly from, you know, which is, that's if they were both maximally spinning the line like this, that's the most you could get. So if they were only spinning at 0.5 of maximality, you would only get a 250 kilometer per second.
Is that the difference between these panels? Like the one on the top left only goes from 0 to 400, whereas the one on the right, top right, goes up to 2,500 or something.
Yeah, exactly. This panel, this left panel corresponds to simulations where the initial configuration is like this, and they're just varying the spin, they're holding them in this direction. Where these guys are all over the place. Exactly. And then, so another question is just people don't know how highly spinning black holes are. If the black holes grow by a merger of smaller black holes, then they have a different typical spin than if they grow via accretion of angular momentum, accretion of gas, all with the same sense of angular momentum. In that case, Bardeen showed if a black hole grows most of its mass by accretion of gas, which all has the same sense of angular momentum, then it'll be spinning at about 0.98 of maximality. It'll be basically nearly maximally spinning. But another possibility, not an unlikely possibility, is that they grow their mass predominantly via gas accretion, but not all, but a series of clouds coming in and. In different directions and orientations and getting eaten by the black hole.
There are either indirect arguments, I guess, the one I remember is you only extract so much energy if it's not rotating, whereas if it's a spinning one, you can get more out. And so if you look at, you know, an eruption from an AGN, you get some estimate of how much energy is being ejected. If you can compare that to the inflow, you can get some kind of efficiency and then hence some indirect handle on whether it was spinning or not.
Thank you again. 10 minutes.